Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, a mortician takes us on a journey around the world to see how different cultures deal with the dead. And we're going to talk about a new greener alternative to burials and cremations. Interesting stuff. But first, birds can be a nuisance to a lot of industries, but their biggest and certainly most long-standing beef has been with farmers. And farmers certainly have a beef with the birds, because just when crops are ready for harvest, birds arrive for a delicious meal, cutting into revenue and crops for the farmers, which is why one blueberry farm in Oregon has had enough. It's putting away the scarecrow and taking out the big guns, laser guns, that is. Here to share with us how farmers are using laser technology as a bird deterrent, as well as other short subjects in science, is Amy Nordrum, associate editor with the IEEE Spectrum. Welcome back, Amy.
Thanks, Ira.
Tell us first about the, you know, we're not talking about shooting the birds with a laser beam, are we?
No.
Let's get that out of the way.
Correct. We're not shooting the birds directly with a laser on this blueberry farm. But, you know, birds do love blueberries as much as we do, maybe even more. So they are a problem to these blueberry farmers. There's a group called a company called Bird Control Group that's developed a laser that they aim at the blueberry bushes. This is a wide green laser beam, sort of sweeps across the bushes during the morning and in the evening when the birds are trying to pick off the berries. And the sweeping motion of the laser, they've found, seems to simulate a predator's approach to certain types of birds, like swallows and robins that are feeding on the berries. So they think it's a predator coming to get them, and this causes them to fly off, which saves the berries.
Have they experimented with different color lights? I mean, why are they using the green light?
They have. They settled on green. They did about 4 years of research and development before coming up with this solution. And they say that the green appears to be about 8 times more intense to the birds rather than versus red. So for some reason, the birds are perceiving green light as more intense. And we don't even really know if they see it in the same colors as us. But
yeah,
that light evoked a much stronger reaction than red light.
Yeah, they just did a colorblind test with the birds.
In a way, yes. It does make a difference. So,
you know, sometimes animals acclimate to things. How do we know that the birds are not going to say, I've seen this before, it's not going to hurt me?
Yeah, I mean, we've all seen examples and photos of scarecrows that have birds, you know, hanging out all around them. So that's absolutely the case. You know, for this laser, for some reason, the birds don't seem to acclimate to this. Company has implemented this solution on farms and food processing facilities, even on fishing ships around the world. And they say that, you know, even years after installing it, the birds seem to still respond to it.
I'm seeing a vision out of Mission Impossible where the laser beams intersect, you know, by the bank vault.
Yeah, usually they do have to set up more than one. So they actually
have
like a grid of 6 lasers, because if you just use one, you actually just end up hurting the birds to one side of the field, and then they still end up eating the berries. So it is a little bit like that actually in real life.
Do you know if other farms, any blueberry farms, ever copying this technique?
Yeah, there's lots of other kinds of farms. There's dairy processing facilities that have been using this. You can imagine oil rigs with all the seagulls on them. There are a couple of the oil rigs around the world have implemented this solution. And there's even been Oregon State University has implemented on their blueberry research farm.
But you can't.
Well,
my Radio Shack doesn't have this yet for myself to put in my.
No, and it's about $10,000 per machine. So, you know, if you have 6 of them in your field, it's a little pricey. But for this one blueberry farm in Oregon, at least they've saved quite a bit of money from the blueberries that they've rescued from the birds.
I'm sure Amazon will have a cheaper version soon. Let's move on to CRISPR. It's having a huge week this week, and in this next study, Chinese scientists have produced a low-fat pig using the gene editor. Now, I've heard of low-fat bacon, but now the whole pig.
Yes, that's right. So they used CRISPR, the gene editing tool, to insert a gene that pigs lack, but which other mammals do have, called UCP1. This gene in other mammals is thought to help other mammals keep warm by burning fat. And since pigs don't have it, they tend to have high susceptibility to cold temperatures, especially young piglets, where farmers, you know, really need to think about using heat lamps to keep them warm so the pigs don't die. So these researchers from the Chinese Academy of Sciences took a UCP1 gene from a mouse and used it to produce 12 piglets. And they found that the piglets with this gene modified through CRISPR were then 24% had 24% less fat and were able to stay warmer compared to piglets without it.
Do we know why they're able to stay warmer?
Well, just the fact that they have this gene seems to be associated with the fact that they're able to produce heat by burning fat. So they're using the fat that they would have had otherwise to actually generate more heat.
Huh. You know, it's sort of an oxymoron, a low fat pig. Eat turkey if you want to.
Right. I mean, the researchers are making the case that this pig could actually be quite useful to farmers because, you know, in cold climates, it can be really hard to keep a bunch of piglets warm. And then there is, you know, supposedly a higher demand for leaner meats these days in the consumer market as well. So I don't know that we'll see this kind of pig on the market anytime soon here in the U.S. It would require, you know, FDA approval and lots of testing, but it's an interesting idea.
Yeah, but it's also a GMO pig.
Absolutely.
So in Europe, they don't like that either.
Yeah, there's a lot of public pushback against this. So interesting experiment, but I wouldn't, you know, expect to be able to buy this low-fat CRISPR pig anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of buying, for our next story, there's a vineyard in Spain that is now making wine using ultrasound. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's a company there called Agroven that has developed this really interesting ultrasound technology. You know, winemaking is this ancient traditional long process, and they are arguing that winemakers could speed it up a little bit by using their ultrasound chamber. It hits the grapes at a certain part of the process right before the stage called maceration that red wines go through, and that's sort of the breakdown of the grape skins. It actually infuses the tannins and the flavor compounds called phenols into the wine itself. This process usually takes as many as 100 days to complete, but by putting the grape pulp through this ultrasound chamber and beaming it with this low-frequency sound, they're able to create these tiny little explosions in the grape skins themselves, which extracts these compounds supposedly faster and might be able to speed up that process to maybe even just a few hours.
So is this being adopted?
So it's been tested in four countries. Different winemakers are trying it out, but it still is awaiting approval by a kind of an international regulatory body that looks at food production techniques. Mm. And then, you know, we'll see if it has any take up. Winemakers might not want to tamper with their process.
No, that's true. And finally, a study that suggests there may be a season for human hair loss.
That's right.
Is there a shedding season for people?
Yeah, you can almost think of it like that. I mean, you know, we're familiar with that with cats and dogs. But researchers over the years have kind of anecdotally and doctors have reported that more people tend to have hair loss in the summer and in the fall. And so there's a new research out in the British Journal of Dermatology that did a Google search trends analysis for the term hair loss worldwide. And they found that searches with the term hair loss were about 5 times more common in the summer and in the fall than in the spring. So there does seem to be some seasonality to human hair loss as well, based on, you know, what people are searching on Google.
Amy, you always bring us fascinating stuff.
Thanks, Ira.
Amy Nordstrom, Associate Editor with the IEEE Spectrum. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. You know those prove you're not a robot forms on websites with a jumble of colored letters and different fonts going every which way? They're called CAPTCHAs, for Completely Automated Public Turing Test, to tell computers and humans apart. And writing this week in the journal Science, researchers describe an artificial intelligence technique that can easily solve them without complex training other AI systems might require. It's a system that's much more efficient at learning about visual information. Joining me to talk about what could be the good thing about that is Scott Phoenix. He's co-author of That Report in Science and co-founder of Vicarious in Union City, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So the bad news first, are we done with CAPTCHAs? Are they all completely broken?
I mean, how is that bad news?
Okay, let's do it from the good news side. That's good news?
I mean, I think there's good news everywhere here. I think that we'll have to enter a lot fewer squiggly characters you really have to squint at to figure out whether it's a B or an A. And I also think in the process we've learned a little bit more about how the human vision system works and how we reason visually.
Now, I know this is not a new problem because you announced that you had solved this a few years ago.
Yes, that's right.
And so what is new about this announcement this week?
Well, a few years ago when we announced we could do it, we didn't publish how, because we wanted to give the outside world time to move on from, you know, making people enter squiggly characters. And so since we announced that we could do it a couple years ago, Google and others have updated their systems so that now you click pictures of dogs or cats or whatever it is in order to prove that you're a human. And so those tests, I think, are a lot more friendly to humans anyway than entering all these squiggly letters. And by giving the outside community some time to update their systems, we made it a lot safer for us to publish our research.
So are you going to break this new system too?
I mean, I think someday, in the long arc of history, artificial intelligence eventually is able to do all the things that humans are currently able to do. And so, yeah, I think there will be this ever-increasing set of tasks that AIs can do and these ever-rising level of tasks and challenges that we give our robot or computer companions to attempt for us.
Mm-hmm. Now, what made it possible for this system to be broken? What special magic is going on?
Well, I think it's all about drawing inductive bias from the brain. So we've learned a lot about the way the brain works in the last 30 years, and that information hasn't quite made it yet into most of the mainstream artificial intelligence algorithms that everyone uses. And so what I think about our work at Vicarious is sort of like arbitrage between what we know now about the brain or we think we know now about the brain and what doesn't yet exist in sort of the mainstream AI approaches.
So the good news now is that this technique can be used for other things.
Yeah, exactly. So at Vicarious, we use it to power robots who can manipulate objects and solve problems visually.
Hmm. So they could the robots sort of do things like picking up widgets, putting them in, sorting them and things, tedious tasks.
Tedious tasks, exactly, and sometimes dangerous tasks, too.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see AI going now?
I think the future of AI is all about robots, actually. I mean, we live in bizarro land right now where all the ingredients that go in a robot, the motors and the plastics and the sensors and electricity, are all really affordable, and nobody owns any robots, and that's an AI problem. I think once we can make intelligences that can control robots the way we control our own bodies, we'll see a lot more robots, and they'll be a lot more affordable.
Okay, Scott, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
So glad to join you.
Scott Phoenix is co-founder of Vicarious in Union City, California. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about death. No, nothing to be afraid of. No experiments on the program today. We'll talk about different ways people handle death around the country, around the world, with author of From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. Caitlin Doty is with us. So take a little bit of time out and come back. We'll see you after the break.
Every memory you think you have of the past.
The house you grew up in. Your first kiss.
It's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. With Halloween just around the corner, we thought we'd talk about death because you see so many death-related icons associated with Halloween, and perhaps that's because death is big business here in the U.S. The industry takes in $16 billion a year from funerals that average around $8,000 apiece. And for most Americans, the choice is simple, cremation or burial, neither of which is a very green option because cremation consumes lots of natural gas and releases toxic chemicals, and bodies are often loaded with embalming chemicals before burial. But green tech is sneaking into the funeral business, too. This month, California Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill allowing so-called water cremation, also known as alkaline hydrolysis, making California the 15th straight state where the process is legal. Water cremation spares the fossil fuels and toxic chemicals and dissolves the body, leaving behind only liquid and powdery bones. So now some Americans have three options for what happens after life. But there are many more, and my next guest crossed the globe, crisscrossed the globe, to document the many ways we deal with death, the topic of her new book, From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. Caitlin Doty is the author, and she's a mortician and funeral home owner in Los Angeles, and she joins us from WBEZ in Chicago today. Welcome to Science Friday.
Such a pleasure to be here.
So tell us a bit about your day job. You own a funeral home.
I do. There's no typical day at the funeral home, but I do. I own a small funeral home in Los Angeles, and our ethos is to get the family more involved. So whether the person wants to, say, keep mom at home for a day or so, whether they want to push the button to start the cremation, whether they want to put the dirt on the grave, we want the family to be more involved.
Now, you write in your book that most people don't realize they have these options.
They don't. Most people have no idea how much power they have around their own dead. The funeral home, me as a funeral director, I don't control your mom's body. That's entirely up to you to make those decisions. And it's completely safe and legal for you to take a little bit more charge when the time comes.
You write in your book how big a business the death business is.
It is, and it's relatively modern.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that we talk about the traditional funeral industry, and when we hear that, you might think embalming and the casket and the makeup, but that's really only been the last 100 years, the 20th century. Traditional American funerals were the person dying at home, taking care of the body at home, and carrying the pine coffin on your shoulders to the local graveyard.
Is it easy to open a funeral home?
It's not, and it's really hard. It's easier in California than other states, but one of the things that I think people don't understand is that it's a huge barrier to entry in the funeral industry. It's highly overregulated, and it's often the funeral home lobbies in individual states that want to keep it highly regulated. So younger women, minorities, immigrants aren't able to open funeral homes that would compete with the status quo embalming, hearse, casket, funeral home.
You know, when I read your book, I was immediately reminded of that film, The Loved One, from 1965.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And what's especially interesting about The Loved One, it's that about the Los Angeles funeral industry, where I'm from. And Los Angeles is really to blame for a lot of the trends in the American funeral world, including the flat headstones, taking away the old, beautiful, archaic, you know, winged skull monuments and headstones. Mm. We also have the idea of the euphemism around death really started at Forest Lawn in Los Angeles, saying, you know, the loved one, or the, you know, just calling the body something different than it really is, the slumber room, etc.
Mm. Let's leave LA for a while and talk about some of the interesting rituals you encountered on your trip around the world. None more unusual to, I think, we Americans than the house graves in Indonesia.
There's a special rural place in Indonesia where they have a ritual called the manene. And what the manene means is that they mummify their dead after the death takes place. And then even years after the death, they continue to remove the bodies from the grave. They remove the clothes, they brush and clean the mummified body, redress them in new clothes, and really have a moment with them, update them on what's been going on, introduce them to a new baby, take some photographs to put on Instagram. But when you're there, I have to say, it feels really normal. It just feels like a family having a moment with a loved one. It doesn't feel creepy or spooky or Norman Bates-like at all.
And you write that the teenagers actually upload Instagram photos?
They do. I am in more than one Instagram photo smiling with a mummified family member because, you know, it's a rural, rural area in the mountains, but they still have smartphones. They still have Instagram. They still have Facebook. And they're proud to go to this ritual where grandpa is being brought out and they're seeing him again. It's just like a normal family photo.
Well, let's talk about cremation. This is a ritual practiced the world over, but I understand from the book it's very different here than it is, let's say, in Japan or India, for example.
It is. In Japan, I mean, for the most part, cremation is much more interactive in other places in the world. In India, they have their open air pyres, and there's an idea that when the skull cracks open, that's the moment when the soul is released. And so it's really hard for many Hindu families and families that come to America when they have to be put in this big industrial machine and the soul essentially gets trapped in the brick chamber. And in Japan, they have something called the kotsuage, which is, okay, so say in America, when you pull out the bones after cremation, we have to grind them down in a machine called the cremulator. But in Japan, the family stands around the skeletonized body after a cremation, and using chopsticks, they pick up the individual bones and place them in an urn, which can sound a little much to us, but I think is actually a really beautiful ritual and incredibly interactive.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, because you have gotten a lot of action on the phones for us. Let's go.
Oh, good. Hi, everyone.
Let's go to Dave in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hi, Dave. David, are you there? Let me.
Oh, R.I.P. Dave.
Sorry.
Hi, Dave. Go ahead. It's my fault, not yours.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I have a question here. I've never wanted to be embalmed. I don't want to be cremated. I want my body to be returned to the earth and all the nutrients that come with that. Now, I've, for the longest time, wanted a Viking burial where you set out to the water and you get set on fire and let into the water. But I've seen these new things recently, too, that are like tree saplings that the body is wrapped in a cloth and there's a tree that's with that, and then it's planted in the ground. I'm just curious about the legalities about stuff like that around here. Is that even an option?
Oh, I wish we had half
either
an hour, because I could get deep into all of those. But I'll give you the short answer, which is you don't have to be embalmed, first of all, at all. It's never legally required that you're embalmed. So don't let them tell you to do that. As far as the Viking funeral, I hate to sort of be a spoil sport here, but it's a bit more of a Hollywood idea, the idea of the flaming arrow and the body burning on the boat. And the reason that's true is because the wood in the boat would burn up so much faster than the actual dead body. So what you're left with is sort of a half-charred corpse bobbing around in the body of water, so not quite as romantic as Hollywood portrays it. But as for the tree urn, I really like them because I love that idea, but ashes after a cremation are inorganic. All the organic material burns away during the cremation process. And so you're left with these inorganic bone fragments, and you can put them and bury them and try and grow a tree from them, but they're not really helping the tree to grow. You can kind of hope they don't kill the tree, but they're not helping the tree. So my personal thing is just to be naturally buried, just to dig a shallow grave, not an embalmed body, put your body in it and go back to the earth and send your nutrients back into the earth where you came from.
Which brings up what I mentioned before, and I'd like a little more detail on this. California being the 15th state to allow water cremation. Walk us through that.
We're really excited about this, and we worked really hard to legalize it, and I hope that my funeral home will be one of the first to offer it. And what it is the deal with cremation is it's often touted as the green option. That's a bit of a stretch. A lot of natural gas is used, enough, I believe, to fill two large SUV tanks full of gas or a 500-mile car trip. And then you also have particulate matter and things coming out of the smokestacks, including mercury from teeth. So it's not the best. The idea behind water cremation, alkaline hydrolysis, aquamation, we haven't totally decided on the term yet, is that it's high pressure and high heat, about 300 plus degrees, water and base chemicals like lye. And what it does in that high pressure, hot environment is it flash decomposes the body down to really brittle bone fragments, similar to what comes out after a cremation. So you wouldn't have to sacrifice getting the ashes back or getting to scatter ashes, but the process itself, people also just, is a little more environmentally friendly, and people just like the idea of cremation by water as opposed to cremation by flame. It seems a little bit more gentler, a little more environmentally friendly, and what I love about it is that you don't have to go to a big industrial warehouse like a crematory to do it. A family can have a nicer area that's just in a nice, beautiful, safe room to have a little ritual and send their loved one off.
Can you legally cremate a body in an open-air pyre anywhere in the U.S.?
There's one public open-air pyre in the Western world, and it's in this tiny town called Crestone, Colorado. And they have done the amazing feat of really stepping outside the American funeral industry and doing all of their, if somebody dies, they come to your house, they help you take care of the body, and then 2 or 3 days later, they process to this gorgeous open-air pyre at dawn, and they set you alight, and the smoke twirls into the sky, and the flames rise up. And even if you're not a spiritual person, it feels like a spiritual moment when you're there.
Is it possible, you talk about this a bit in your book, about composting?
Composting, yes. This is also so similar to something like alkaline hydrolysis or water cremation. Body composting or recomposition is an attempt to replace cremation with a more environmentally friendly option. And this one's still more in the prototype stage. It's a friend of mine, Katrina Spade, who's spearheading it. And they've done several experiments, one at Western Carolina University in North Carolina, where they put bodies in big piles of wood chips, and the idea is that it gets hot and the microbes do their thing, and within a month, eventually, the body will be down to soil. It'll transform into soil, including the bones. So what you get back isn't remains. What you get back is a whole new product. It's soil.
So what I'm hearing you saying is that every state has different rules about how you bury a body.
That's what can make it difficult, because every single one of these things we're talking about has to be legalized individually in each state. It doesn't happen at the federal level. So each state has to legalize water cremation. Each state has to legalize recomposition or body composting. It's a fight at each level.
Mm-hmm. What more would you like to learn about?
What more would I like? Yeah. Would I like to travel?
Just as a mortician, someone with a funeral home, is there anything new to learn about how bodies decompose or different ways of burial?
Oh, there absolutely is. I can't even tell you how many things I want to learn. I'm fascinated. So there's a new thing called conservation burial, and it's basically taking, it's the idea of natural burial, just a simple burial with no embalming, but it's also protecting endangered land, protecting land that might otherwise be developed on. But when you bury a body there, they can't develop on it. I say it's like chaining yourself to a tree post-mortem. And I would like more big environmental groups to be involved in this and to really consider these beautiful spaces as the future of death.
Mm-hmm. Talking about death with author Caitlin Doty, author of From Here to Eternity. She's a mortician and funeral owner in Los Angeles on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. As you can see there, I imagine there are a lot of people who would like to ask questions. Let's go to Brooklyn with Randall. Hi, Randall.
Hi, Ira. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi.
I had a question about the mummification process in Indonesia.
Go ahead.
Is there an amount of time that that the departed ones stay with the family? And then also I was wondering if they do anything similar anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, those are great questions. So as far as how the actual mummification works, it was interesting because I would talk to different people and it was sort of the hush-hush scandal. Some people would say, well, I only mummify in the old way. And the old way is using tea leaves and tannins, almost like you would leatherize, a piece of leather to mummify the body. But then they would also say, but I know other people are doing it in the new way. And the new way is just formaldehyde or formalin, like an American embalmer would use to preserve a dead body. And it depends how long the person stays in the home. Sometimes it's a couple months. Sometimes it can even be years that a person stays in the home until the funeral, enough money is able to be raised for the funeral for this to happen. And as far as it happening in other places in the world, you know what? They preserve their dead bodies with formalin, with these chemicals. We preserve our dead bodies with formalin, with these chemicals. It's not all that different. But we, of course, would think about bringing the dead bodies out as horrifying. But my question there is, they have a reason for mummifying their bodies with all these chemicals. Why are we doing it in the United States if we don't intend to bring mom out a couple years later?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jane in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I think that probably the greenest way to dispose of a body is to donate it to a body farm. And there are, I believe, 7 of them around the United States where they study human decomposition. No embalming chemicals need to be used. And then once the body decomposes, the bones go into a permanent collection for research purposes.
I'm totally with you. Yeah, I agree. And actually, the composting experiments that I was talking about earlier were done on a body farm. That's what Western Carolina University has. So I know that the woman who runs it was incredibly grateful that those people were willing to give their body up for this important research.
And quickly, there was some news this week about how bodies donated to science are sometimes sold off as parts or rented out.
They are. And I have people always ask me, shouldn't we just donate our bodies to science? And I hate that sometimes I have to hesitate in my answer because things like that happen all the time. We do run into these where the people are donating their body to science, think they're going off to cure cancer and to study these very noble things. But in fact, they're being used for plastic surgery training. They're being used for parts, essentially. And if you're cool with that, absolutely give your body up to science. But if you're not okay with that, please do your research before you decide to donate.
Thank you, Caitlin, for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Caitlin Doty is author of From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. If you're looking for an interesting Halloween gift, this is a different kind of gift. A fascinating book and something you might want to read. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, speaking of Halloween, we're going to talk about spiders. Spiders are everywhere in Halloween decorations, right? Why do we have arachnophobia? Why are we so fearful of spiders? We're going to learn how to identify the brown recluse, how spiders benefit us, and cool spider tricks that you can see right in your own home. Yes, you can try this at home, so stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. We have one last comforting thought for you this Halloween. Unless you live in Antarctica, you are almost never more than 4 feet away from a spider. There's probably a spider in the same room as you are right now. And yes, there are even spiders in the Arctic. This is a scary thought for people with arachnophobia. But even the most ardent spider fan might feel at least a hint of nervousness if they saw a black widow or the notorious brown recluse whose bite sometimes leaves gruesome marks on the skin. But my next guest wants you to feel less afraid of those brown recluses. And if you're afraid of all spiders, they want you to feel better about that too. Maybe you'll even go looking for them to do your own spider science, whether it's a cellar spider's fast-spinning defense mechanism, a spitting spider's deadly blob of venom and web, or a crab spider's expert color-changing camouflage. Here to tell us why there's nothing to fear, maybe a lot to love, are my guests, Eleanor Spicer Rice, an entomologist and author of the forthcoming book, Dr. Eleanor's Book of Common Spiders. She's based in Raleigh, South Carolina. Catherine Scott, an arachnologist and PhD student at the University of Toronto. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks.
Hi.
For having us.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have you both always loved spiders?
I have not always loved spiders. This is Eleanor.
You both
what
said
about you,
no.
Catherine?
Yeah, no, I used to be terrified of spiders until I was about 25 years old and started studying them. So, it's definitely not a lifelong love. It's something that I've learned recently to love spiders.
And how do you get over that fear?
So for me, the process of turning fear to fascination was relatively quickly, and it was just all about spending time with spiders, watching their behavior, and learning more about them. So I think the more you know, the more you understand spiders, and the less reason you have to fear them.
Mm-hmm. Now, Catherine, I know you're working on a citizen science project to help people identify whether they've got a brown recluse or not. Is this because recluses are so dangerous?
So they have this horrible reputation, especially in North America. People are terrified of brown recluses. They think that if you get bitten by a brown recluse, your arm is going to rot off. You're going to die. You're going to have to get an amputation. And there's a bit of hysteria around it that's really way overblown relative to the real risk. Brown recluse spiders rarely bite. And when they do, it's only a very small proportion, like 10% of the bites that are actually really serious. But those are the ones that people hear about on the media and the gruesome wounds that you'll see if you search brown recluse bite online. So there's a bias towards the really severe, really rare cases of brown recluse bites.
Yeah, this reminds me when I was a kid, people talking about black widow spiders the same way.
Yeah, exactly. And black widows as well. I study them. I work with them every day. I handle them. So I spend a lot of time with them. I've never been bitten. So if you're not going out looking for black widows, they have no interest in humans. They're actually really shy and secretive, just like recluse spiders. There's a reason they're called recluse spiders, because they are reclusive. And yeah, they have no interest in you. And the risk that they pose is really, really small.
Catherine actually tried to make black widows bite her for a project, and she couldn't get them to bite her unless she squeezed them.
Is that true?
So that wasn't actually me, sorry, but that was a really cool study that came out a couple of years ago that I wrote about on my blog. So yeah, a scientific study trying to make black widows bite by poking and prodding them found that if you poke them and prod them and just repeatedly harass them, they're either going to run away because they're much more afraid of us than we are of them. They're going to play dead to try to get us to leave them alone, or they'll fling sticky silk, which is their main defense. It was only when the researchers squeezed them between silicone fingers that the spiders ever bit. And even then, only about 60% of the time would the black widows bite when they were being squeezed and had no other recourse. And at that point, they're doing biting as a last-ditch defense. And then they also found that when the spiders did bite defensively, over half of those bites were dry. They didn't actually inject any venom. Hmm. So they can control whether or not they inject venom when they bite. And it turns out that venom is really expensive metabolically for spiders to produce. And it's for subduing prey. It's not actually for defense. And it's not very effective at defense. So they want to save up their venom for their next meal and not waste it on biting.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about your citizen science project about identifying the recluse. How do people participate?
So all you have to do is, if you see a spider that you think is a brown recluse, you tweet it. You take a little picture of it and tweet it to us at recluse or not. And one of either myself or Catherine or another arachnologist, Matt Bertone, will identify the spider for you and tell you if it's a recluse or not. So then you can know that's not here.
And what are you learning about all these pictures that are being sent to you?
Well, one thing that we're learning is that most people think that every single spider that they see in their house is a brown recluse, whether it looks like one or not. And a lot of people who don't live anywhere near brown recluses think that they have brown recluses in their house. So, and another thing that we're learning is that people who do live in areas where brown recluses live can live in houses with tons and tons of recluses and just peacefully and not even realize that they are completely surrounded by lots of brown recluses.
Here's a tweet from Nasty Pantsuit who says, I love spiders. I live in Australia and a brood of baby huntsmen hatched in the house. Really cute. What are baby huntsmen for us who don't know that?
So huntsman spiders, they're also known as giant crab spiders. And we do have some huntsmen in North America, but only in the south. They're also fairly common in houses. And the babies are really cute. Actually, one of the things that I love about spiders is a lot of them have parental care. The mothers will carry the babies around on their back. In wolf spiders, for instance, or in the social velvet spiders, mothers will actually regurgitate food for their babies, just like bird parents do for their offspring. So, spiders take really good care of their babies.
I mean, you two just we're having a love fest about spiders here.
They're pretty great.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I was just saying they don't seem great at first, but really, if you just take a few minutes to stare at any spider that's around you, you'll realize they're pretty awesome.
I have to admit that I love spiders too, and I have.
Oh.
Yeah, I.
Because but have you always loved spiders?
Well, yeah, you know, because I figure if there are spiders in my house, there's something they would like to eat, and it's something I don't like to have around. Is what they're eating.
That's true. That's true. The spiders aren't going to be living in your house unless they have something to eat. So they're there doing something for you in your house. And they do the same thing in agricultural fields. They found that if you take lynx spiders out of agricultural fields, the pest populations just skyrocket because they're there eating all of these pests, you know, without pesticides. They do tons of wonderful things just from eating.
What kinds of things do they eat in my house?
In your house?
In the house?
They eat
Yeah.
You can tell, Catherine.
Okay. I mean, they're eating anything that is an insect or even other spiders. So anything that's sort of crawling on 6 to 8 legs, spiders will eat it for sure. And like Eleanor said, they're excellent roommates. You already know, having spiders in your house, they earn their keep by eating the things that you don't want around, especially things like mosquitoes. And there's actually one spider species, which is, this isn't its official name, but I like to call it the vampire spider. It is a jumping spider that actually specializes on eating the mosquitoes that transmit malaria. It especially likes to eat the ones that have fed on human blood. So indirectly, it's feeding on human blood, but it's doing us a favor by eating those mosquitoes that would otherwise be transmitting diseases.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are some people who are afraid of spiders because they think that while they're sleeping and have they're snoring or have their mouth open, a spider is going to crawl in and they're going to swallow it.
Yes, but that doesn't really actually happen. I mean, I don't think a spider wants to be anywhere near your mouth.
Unless
you have little bugs crawling out of your mouth, which that then you have other problems that we need to worry about.
I've seen the movie.
Yeah, and that's a very popular misconception that spiders want to go in your mouth. And that's definitely a myth. And another one that goes along with that is that spiders crawl into your bed and bite you in your sleep. Again, like spiders have no reason to crawl into your bed to bite you. They're interested in biting insects and other arthropods, not humans. They don't feed on us, so they have absolutely no reason to bite us.
One tweet comes in from Steve. It says, how can I tell the difference between a brown recluse and a wolf spider?
Well, that's
excellent
a great question because a lot of people think that they have wolf spiders. That their wolf spiders are brown recluses. But Catherine, do you want to give the features of a brown recluse?
Sure, yeah. So there's a few things. So if you've got a recluse spider, it's going to have a violin mark, but that's not enough because there are a lot of spiders that also have a violin pattern on them. So to tell that it's not a brown recluse, that it's a wolf spider, for instance, it's going to have 8 eyes rather than 6. Recluses only have 6. Most other spiders, including wolf spiders, also have big spines on their legs, whereas brown recluses only have very, very fine hair. Recluses never have stripes on their legs, which a lot of other spiders do. Am I missing the last one, Eleanor?
Well, wolf spiders don't usually have webs, but brown recluses also don't have webs. So if you're trying to tell the recluse from other spiders that if you see a spider hanging out in a web that you think is a brown recluse, they don't hang out in webs. They can build cobwebs, but they don't really live in those webs.
Yeah, if it's on an orb web or a big space-filling web, definitely not a brown recluse. And wolf spiders don't build webs at all. They're always running around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're always running around hunting for stuff.
I've seen them in my basement, so they're big and
lucky
hairy.
Lucky you.
Big and hairy things.
Excellent roommates.
Is that
they
right?
They are.
Why do you say that?
They're again, eating all of your pests.
They're also really fun to watch. So wolf spiders and also jumping spiders, which you'll also find if you go out on a sunny day and look at the wall of your house or your fence, you'll often see jumping spiders. And they're super fun to watch because they're visual hunters, just like tiny little cats. And they'll pounce on their prey just like a cat. So if you can spend some time
really
watching
cute.
Those visual predators. Oh, and they're adorable. Yeah,
they have
spiders
big eyes.
Can be really
they look
beautiful.
Like they have little mustaches.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And if you've never seen a peacock spider, please go and Google peacock spider right now because they're the most beautiful animals in the world. They look like their abdomen looks like a peacock's tail that's rainbow colored. And you can't not start to like spiders a little bit once you've seen a peacock spider.
I think we're changing minds by the second on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Catherine Scott and Eleanor Spicer Rice, author of Dr. Eleanor's Book of Common Spiders. We just have to talk about this because I know it's talked about a lot, and that is spider sex. I've got some bizarre...
This is my favorite topic.
Go for
it. Me too. Well, every spider can eat every other spider, right? Because they're predators. So to keep each other from eating each other, they have developed some pretty crazy behaviors to tell each other that they're mates. Can I just tell you like one of my favorite ones that's kind of creepy?
Please.
Okay. So there are these spiders called grass spiders. And that you know how when you like look out in your lawn and you see those sheet webs in between your grass with little funnel on the end of it? Yeah. Those are the grass spiders. And the male, what he does is he'll go up to the web and he'll flex the sheet very gently. And then while he's doing it, he waves his abdomen in the air very hypnotically to do this like sexy dance on the web. And if the female looks like she's interested, he'll release a chemical and she'll pass out cold. And then he'll just jump on her and go for it. And then he, before she can wake up and eat him, he runs away. It's my favorite. What about you, Catherine? What's your favorite spider sex?
Well, I really love black widows because they're the species that I study. And I like this because it sort of helps people to understand that spiders have more in common with us than you might think. So black widows literally do web-based personal ads. So the female black widow has a smell on her silk, on her web, that is an advertisement that provides males with information about her, where she is, whether she's mated before, and even whether or not she's hungry, which, like Eleanor was saying, is really important. If the female is hungry, she poses a threat to the male when he enters her web. He might become a meal rather than a mate. So, spiders are great at using chemicals to communicate with one another, which most people probably don't think about.
Last question. It's Halloween next week, and in that vein, there's a kind of spider that is almost like kind of a vampire, Eleanor?
Oh, that's the one that can eat mosquitoes, the big, fat, bloody-filled mosquitoes. But there are other Halloween-type spiders, too, because a lot of spiders wear Halloween costumes all year round. They mimic all kinds of different creatures. Catherine, do you want to tell some of your favorites?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. So one of the coolest ones is spiders that mimic ants. So a lot of spiders have highly modified bodies, so you can barely tell that they're a spider, not an ant. And they walk like an ant. They hang out with ants, so they look very similar to ants. And then there are also other spiders that masquerade as inanimate objects, like bird poop, like twigs and leaves and flowers. And so they wear these costumes, so to speak, to either avoid predators. So by looking like an ant that's well defended and distasteful, or by looking like a leaf or bird poop, which doesn't taste good, or they can even look like a flower, for instance, in order to ambush insects that are coming to visit that flower. Wow. For nectar.
Now, if I wanted to go to a Halloween party dressed up as a spider, what would you suggest I wear?
I would go for the black widow.
Would you really? I would go for a spinning spider.
Oh, yeah. They're great.
Oh, they're really great.
What would I be wearing? What kind of costume? What would I put on?
Well, you could just go around and spit on people. They spit these death loogies on their, they're like scavengers. And they live, and they're very common. They live all around us. I have them in my kitchen. And they go up to their prey, and instead of jumping on them, they just spit these venomous death loogies on them and tangle them down. It's all sticky. And then they go up to this goopy thing and eat it. So you could just be the grossest spider.
Well, I think you have solved that problem.
It wouldn't make
you
the most popular person at the party, but
most original costume, I'll bet.
Be very accurate. Yeah.
And I think that is the most original costume we've ever had on Science Friday Night. 26 years we've been on the air. Thank you both for your fascinating. Spicer Rice's book is called Dr. Eleanor's Book of Common Spiders. And she's based in Raleigh, South Carolina. Catherine Scott is an arachnologist and a PhD student at the University of Toronto. And if you ever wonder what spiders you're seeing in your home, you can head over to sciencefriday.com/commonspiders to see pictures, learn facts, find out all about these spiders. sciencefriday.com/commonspider. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're welcome. One last thing before we go. All you Bay Area listeners, Annie Minoff and Ella Fetter, the hosts of Undiscovered, our podcast, will be joining Mythbuster Adam Savage at the Bay Area Science Festival. That's tomorrow night, October 28th at the Castro Theater. Get your tickets at sciencefriday.com/Bay Area. Tomorrow night at the Castro Theater, sciencefriday.com/Bay Area. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.